Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is April 24th, 1977, and this is my monthly audio letter number 23. 2 months ago, in audio letter number 21 for February 1977, I explained how America had been turned into a nationwide energy addict over the course of two generations and more, and how this energy addiction is to be used against us by the four Rockefeller brothers in turning off our national security. And just 4 days ago, on April 20, 1977, this process got underway in earnest by way of David Rockefeller's revolutionary energy program announced to the world by his employee Jimmy Carter. To the casual observer, it must seem incredible. A new administration under a new president with no previous experience in Washington has in only 3 short months done what no previous administration has ever succeeded in doing, developed a comprehensive, detailed energy program for the most complex economy on Earth. Furthermore, Mr. Carter tells us that we must do as he tells us in order to avoid, quote, a national catastrophe, unquote. And he says we must act now. Why the rush? Why this sudden urgency? And why does he go out of his way to call his energy program, quote, the moral equivalent of war, unquote? The answer lies in what I warned you about at the end of monthly audio letter number 22 just last month. The CIA is hard at work arranging what is to be the CIA's crowning achievement, the staging of a horrendous act of terrorism that is intended to cause war to erupt in the whole of the Middle East. This is to set in motion a modified, updated version of the detailed war plan I revealed in monthly audio letter number 6 for November 1975. This plan includes a limited nuclear strike from the Sinai to cap off Arab OPEC oil wells, except those in Libya, which is controlled by the CIA. This will lead immediately to very harsh energy rationing in the United States, and the federal government will at last get to issue those precious gas rationing coupons that have been awaiting use now for over 3 years. So the Carter Energy Plan, with its underlying warlike atmosphere, is actually the first step in a gradual shift onto a war footing for the United States. It has the same purpose as the Declaration of National Emergency, which President Franklin D. Roosevelt proclaimed in May 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor, to start getting America ready for war he was helping to bring about. The second major step in our progressive shift onto war footing is intended to occur at the time of the cutoff of Middle East oil by war. This will provide a perfect excuse for an actual declaration of national emergency, and that in turn will activate all the dictatorial presidential powers spelled out in Executive Order 11-921, signed by President Ford very quietly in June 1976 and described in my audio letter number 14. For July 1976. Audio letter number 14, of course, is also the issue in which I first revealed the presence of Soviet underwater missiles and bombs in our own territorial waters. The terrible Middle East incident now brewing, which I fervently hope and pray will somehow be sidetracked by its advanced exposure, is to cause a limited nuclear war in the Middle East. That in turn is supposed to initiate a chain of events culminating in nuclear war one between the Soviet Union and the United States of America. Originally, this was to have been a carefully programmed war for the mutual benefit of the Rockefeller cartel and their Soviet allies, with the Rockefellers and their intimates riding out the war safely in the nuclear safe zone across the northern United States. But ever since the Soviet Union began its double cross of the Rockefellers last summer, 1976, the plans for war have been undergoing frantic revisions. Even the insane Rockefeller concessions to the Soviets, embodied in the Red Friday Agreement of October 1, 1976, which I revealed that month in audio letter number 17, have failed to fully reinstate the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance. So now, anything can happen. The Rockefeller brothers, who for so long have tried to play God with their immense power, are now finding out that they too are fallible and human, even if they still refuse to consciously admit it. Today, my friends, the power of the Rockefeller Empire is in the process of destroying itself. But just as Samson pulled down the temple around him, the Rockefeller brothers threaten to pull down modern civilization around their heads as their power runs out of control and collapses into the inferno of nuclear war. Earlier this month, on April 7, 1977, Prime Minister Rabin of Israel resigned. The press has played up his resignation as if it were another Watergate, but actually, it was only a technicality having to do with a modest bank account held here in Washington, D.C. by Rabin against government regulations. Overnight, Rabin was out of office, and his public career has been described as ruined. But the real reason for Rabin's lightning exit from Israeli politics was that he learned of the CIA plot to ignite war in the Middle East, and he wanted no part of it. It's almost a replay of Sir Harold Wilson's sudden unexplained resignation as Prime Minister of Great Britain on March 16, 1976, just over a year ago. And as I explained then in monthly audio letter number 10, Wilson resigned because he had learned of the coming war plan and wanted nothing to do with it. And so the build-up toward war continues, and our rulers know it. But what of the American public in general? How many know what danger we are in? And especially, how many believe it enough to do something about it? My friends, most Americans today are on vacation from reality. But reality will have to be faced one day in the not-too-distant future. My three special topics for today are topic number one, the pre-war sabotage of America. Topic number two, the coming naval battle for the United States and the world. And topic number three, the untold personal sacrifice of General George S. Brown. Topic number one, in the early days of the 20th century, the Rockefeller Standard Oil monopoly had already become supreme in the United States, but abroad it faced two powerful competitors in oil. One was the British Empire, whose destruction by means of two world wars I've discussed in a number of my past talking tapes. The other foreign competitor was even bigger than the British Empire in oil, and it was attacked and destroyed first. That competitor was Tsarist Russia. After the Bolshevik Revolution took place in 1917, property owners and businessmen of all kinds were dispossessed and liquidated in great numbers. And included in this by design was the utter destruction of the oil fields, refineries, oil tankers, everything having to do with oil. The small band of revolutionaries under Lenin and Trotsky, who had been sent into Russia with the help of Rockefeller financing, had done their job well. And within a few years, the new communist regime of the Soviet Union welcomed the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests with open arms to redevelop the huge Russian oil reserves. Ever since that day, right down to the present, practically all the oil leaving the Soviet Union has been carried on oil tankers of the Rockefeller Standard Oil Empire under various names, nominees, and national flags. For a thorough and most unusual expose of the oil competition presented to the Rockefellers by Tsarist Russia, I highly recommend a new book by Robert V. Tolf, T-O-L-F, entitled The Russian Rockefellers, The Saga of the Nobel Family and the Russian Oil Industry, published by the Hoover Institution Press, Stanford University, Stanford, California, 94305. The price is $15.95 postpaid. For decades following the Bolshevik Revolution, The Soviet rulers were absolutely dependent upon an uninterrupted flow of transfusions from the West, of money, technical know-how, food, and arms. The Kremlin ruled a huge nation with an iron fist, and the Rockefellers shared this rule with the Kremlin. The Soviet Union therefore appeared to be the perfect vehicle for bringing the entire world under the control of the super-rich Rockefellers and their intimates. All that was necessary, or so they thought, was to gradually build up the Soviet system while bleeding to death the harder-to-control United States and the Western world. This was the situation the four Rockefeller brothers inherited long ago. They literally grew up with it and could hardly imagine things being any different. But now things are different. The Soviet Union can now survive without continued outside help. And now they have been double-crossing the Rockefellers, and we the people will have to suffer for it. Now both the Rockefellers and the Soviets are maneuvering, playing a tricky game, and all the while trying to emerge supreme from the conflict to come. But just as it was planned before the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance began coming apart, the main and prime battleground is to be the United States of America. The Soviet Union is busy at work trying to weaken America here and abroad so that we can be defeated in nuclear war I. And the Rockefellers are trying to turn our nation into a complete dictatorship under their domination. Both are trying to bend the weakening of America's freedom to their own special advantage. The centerpiece of the Rockefeller program to completely take over America right now is the so-called Carter Energy Program. Recently, the CIA suddenly upgraded its estimates of Soviet spending for new military equipment and installations to 4 times the previous figure, so as to alarm us. In a similar vein, the CIA has also provided Jimmy Carter with grist for his energy meal to grind us into submission by issuing a report saying world oil reserves are much lower than previously thought. Both CIA reports are rubbish, issued purely for propaganda purposes. So the CIA, under Admiral Turner, who is a Rockefeller man, is continuing with the preparations for the limited nuclear strike from the Sinai in order to get the war started. American F-15 fighter bombers are now available in the Sinai, able to hit all the 5 or more Arab target areas with ease. And the special low-yield nuclear weapons for the job are already on the scene, currently stored underground at the so-called American Monitoring Station in the Sinai. The bombs themselves are atomic, not hydrogen, very clean, with primary blast effects confined to a radius of only 300 to 400 yards. Just right for a so-called surgical attack to wipe out the oil wells in the target areas. As for America, even though the Alaskan oil is supposed to start flowing through the pipeline this summer, it would not come into the lower United States. It happens to be high sulfur oil, of a type which West Coast refineries cannot handle, even though there have been 10 years to get ready for Alaskan oil. Instead, the Rockefeller plan is to ship this oil to Japan, at a handsome profit, of course, and make up the difference with more imports of, guess what, Arab oil. When the Arab oil is cut off, there will be some attempts to ship some of the otherwise useless Alaskan oil to the Gulf Coast by small, inefficient tankers through the Panama Canal, which is targeted both by underwater missiles and by missiles in Guyana. The sharp drop in our oil supplies will also help to intensify the reduction in food supplies, which is already resulting from drought here in America. Many factors are contributing to the drought situation, including not only the Soviet weather modification activities I've mentioned in the past, but also activities under Rockefeller control. For example, I mentioned in audio letter number 9 for February 1976 that for years the Rockefeller oil companies have been knowingly lowering the underground water table in many areas of the Midwest and Great Plains by means of excessive pumping from their oil wells. And now, in many of these very areas, the problem of low groundwater is adding to the drought crisis. Meanwhile, the Rockefellers never lose sight of their objectives, no matter how much they are forced to change their tactics along the way. Their objective for America is dictatorship, according to the pattern spelled out in their secret new constitution, which I revealed in my audio book talking tape number 4, released in July 1975. Under the guise of, quote, governmental reorganization, unquote, the provisions of their dictatorial new constitution are being imposed on the United States piecemeal, gradually, while our real constitution is increasingly interpreted out of existence. But of all the things that determine whether a nation will survive or succumb in time of crisis, the human spirit is still the most important. A strong spirit and deep resolve can overcome seemingly insurmountable obstacles, and it can make a people impossible to conquer. But a weak spirit, without convictions or values, leaves a people defenseless, no matter how much armor they may wear or what weapons they may command. This is why the human spirit has been the most consistent target of all, both of the Rockefeller One World Group and of the rulers of the Soviet Union. Last month in audio letter number 22, I pointed out one of the extremes in church philosophy that has been promoted wherever possible for generations by the Rockefellers and their collaborators. This extreme is to divorce the moral and spiritual lessons of religions from daily decisions and actions, as if the two had no relationship to one another except for lip service. For whatever reasons, this extreme is personified today by one Jimmy Carter. The opposite extreme is equally deadly, if not more so. This is to dilute the spiritual teaching for which churches originally existed and replace it with preaching about economic, political, and social issues. To do this is to play with fire. But this is exactly what the National Council of Churches and its sister organization, the World Council of Churches, have been doing for decades. Prior to November 28, 1950, the National Council was known as the Federal Council of Churches. For many years, the Federal Council had been dominated at the national level by the Rockefellers and their agent John Foster Dulles, and was the recipient of several grants from the Rockefeller Foundation. But the Federal Council became so totally identified with political activism in support of socialist causes that it became an object of increasing distrust. Accordingly, the name was changed to the National Council of Churches, and its tarnished halo was polished up with public assurances that this was a new organization which would devote itself to the real business of the church. There were many influential laymen in the churches under the umbrella of the National Council who wanted to help ensure that the supposedly new organization would truly devote itself to proper areas of church concern. As a result, a National Lay Committee was brought into being under the chairmanship of the late J. Howard Pugh, a truly great American, who was the director and president of the Sun Oil Company when it was still free of the grasping clutches of the Rockefellers. The National Lay Committee existed from March 28, 1951 until June 30, 1955. The whole story of what happened to the National Lay Committee of the National Council of Churches is told in the chairman's final report by J. Howard Pugh. Unfortunately, this important report has long been suppressed and buried. I have in my possession one of the very few copies still known to be in existence. Therefore, I will read a few brief passages from the chairman's explanatory letter, which serves as a foreword to the report as a whole. These quotations are taken in sequence, and although they do not do justice to Mr. Pugh's complete explanatory letter, much less the entire 316-page report, I believe you'll find them revealing. Quote, in the failure of this most important effort to bring about an enduring partnership between the clergy and laity, I feel a very real responsibility to provide a comprehensive and factual account of those steps which led to the Board's action discontinuing lay participation. Quote, "We lay people found ourselves not only deeply in the minority, but often poles apart from the clergy who invariably outvoted us 10-1 in these sessions." Quote, "The members of the lay committee were often misunderstood in their urgency to keep the churches out of politics and their insistence on the primacy of evangelism. Our premise was that instead of appealing to government, the church should devote its energies to the work of promoting the attributes of Christianity, truth, honesty, fairness, generosity, justice, and charity in the hearts and minds of men. We attempted to emphasize that Christ stressed not the expanded state, but the dignity and responsibility of the individual." Quote, "Their philosophy, it seemed to the lay committee, looked to an ever-expanding government." Quote, "With few exceptions, the members of the lay committee had agreed to serve only because they had been assured that the new National Council would avoid the political involvements and controversies of the old Federal Council of Churches, which was now superseded." Quote, "Most of the members of the lay committee came finally to the realization that a wide chasm existed between the thinking of the laity and the clergy and executives of the denominational bodies which comprise the National Council." Quote, "Thus on June 30, 1955, the lay committee ceased to exist as a committee of the General Board." Quote, "The members of the lay committee believed and so stated that the political adventures of the National Council in the fields of economic and political controversy would seriously hinder and not further Christian leadership in the pressing fields of evangelism, fellowship, and education." Quote, "It appears from the record that the National Council could find no room for opposition to the philosophies and practices carried over from the old Federal Council, lacking the patience to resolve the basic problem, it has sought to bury it." Unquote. Thus ended, my friends, more than 20 years ago, the last major effort to deflect the Rockefeller-dominated National Council of Churches away from its political programs and toward concern for spiritual matters. After more than 4 years of frustrating effort, the National Lay Committee was dissolved. This signaled the end of any influence of the general church population of America on the policies of the National Council of Churches. The National Council proceeded on its way, proclaiming to the public that it represented 34 million Protestants, while using this power base to help undermine our free republic. The National Council has done much to help dull and weaken the spirit of millions of Americans, softening our approach and opposition to communism. Let us hope and pray that in these dangerous days they will at last see the light and begin to work at last to build up the American spirit instead of destroying it. Topic number 2. In monthly audio letter number 15 for August 1976, I explained that the planting of short-range underwater-launched nuclear missiles in our territorial waters was part of the Soviet naval strategy for the United States and world conquest. The same continues to be the case now. Admiral Gorshkov, who has commanded the Soviet Navy for more than 20 years, has built it into a fighting force that is radically different from any other navy the world has ever seen. And as we near the very threshold of war, it is no accident that the Rockefeller insider who now heads the CIA is also an admiral, 4-star Admiral Stansfield Turner. The CIA has become the most powerful military organization in the United States, and nuclear war one will revolve around naval strategy. Both the importance of the Soviet Navy and its great difference from our own United States Navy can be illustrated by just one fact. When the supersonic backfire long-range bomber entered operational service in the Soviet Union late in 1974, it did so simultaneously with the Soviet Navy as well as with the Soviet Air Force. This is like giving our own new supersonic bomber, the B-1, to our Navy to fly, or, since we still do not have the B-1 to counter the Soviet backfire, having our Navy fly B-52s. Of course, our own Navy does not fly strategic bombers. The United States Navy, like the British Navy and most of the other great navies of history, has, as one of its primary missions, the protection of our sea lanes of commerce, a role which is basically defensive in nature. Since World War II, our Navy has also acquired offensive missions, which have gradually assumed greater importance, including the ability to attack an enemy from the sea with a submarine-launched ballistic missiles. But the traditional defensive mission of protecting our sea lanes can never be neglected. Admiral Gorshkov, however, has been able to concentrate on building a Navy which is almost totally offensive in character. Soviet fishing trawlers, some of them genuine, roam the world, but the Soviet Union does not depend for its survival on the sea nearly as much as the United States. So the Soviet Navy is designed first and foremost for offensive operations, and this not only includes the ability to interdict enemy sea lanes and attack enemy naval forces at sea, it also includes an unprecedented emphasis on projecting naval power ashore. This in turn means not only the ability to carry out amphibious assaults and tactical bombardment, but strategic attack, a role we usually tend to think of only in terms of the Soviet Air Force with its ICBMs and bombers.